Thanks very much for that introduction. I just want to thank the organisers for giving me the opportunity to present here today. So today I'm going to be talking to you about what we look at doing in the lab, and that's looking at utilising molecular testing for gonorrhea resistance and how it can impact controlling gonorrhea. I do have to disclose that we do report research funding from SpeedX, and I'll be talking a little bit how we've been collaborating with them on recent projects as well. So generally in the media, often when gonorrhea pops up, it's often associated with these multi-drug resistant strains or super gonorrhea or super strains. And generally the media likes to put their own hype on things, but generally some of those I think are just generally more questionable than others. But you know, it is genuinely becoming a real concern and what we're trying to deal with recently. We're even starting to see these media headlines pop up in Australia as well in 2017 and also more recently in 2018, where we identified a case here in WA but also in Queensland, and that case was also found in the UK as well. So David Spears this morning, if you were there, provided a nice diagram of the introduction of antibiotics and resistance, and this is just reiterating that. Gonorrhea has this incredible ability to generate rapid resistance to any sort of antibiotic we really chuck at it, and this timeline essentially just shows when the antibiotic was first reported, and below the timeline we show the evidence of resistance. We started off with sulfonamides in the mid-1930s, and then resistance soon followed. And then we see this gradual pattern occurring for every single antibiotic, even up until the point now where we're dealing with ceftriaxone resistant strains. And this is quite concerning, given we want to try and retain ceftriaxone as our mainstay treatment for gonorrhea. And I think rightly so, you know, that both the WHO and the CDC have either listed it as a high priority or an urgent threat. So in terms of ceftriaxone resistance specifically, it's generally split into two classes, and David Spears touched on this morning. We deal with decreased susceptible strains, and we're starting to see increasing numbers of these worldwide, and a few of these have even been associated with pharyngeal treatment failures. And then we actually look at the ceftriaxone resistant strains. And for a period of time there, you know, there wasn't much happening, it was all good. They were quite sporadic, limited transmission, and then we started dealing with these, essentially, cases where we started to see spread both here in Australia and elsewhere. This case initially popped up in 2018 called the A2543 strain, and as David Spears talked about this morning, it also exhibited high levels of resistance to azithromycin as well, which is quite concerning given our current dual therapy guidelines utilise both ceftriaxone and azithromycin. And then we also have this incredible FC428 strain, which I'm sure will be talked about in this conference a fair bit. It was initially reported in Japan in 2015 and has since been found in several other countries, including Australia as well, and as Deb alluded to earlier, identified multiple cases this year. Interestingly enough, though, this particular FC428 strain appears to harbour the same ceftriaxone resistance mechanism as the A2543 strain, and this is specifically referred to as the mosaic pen-A allele or pen-A60. So what do we currently do to try and combat antibiotic-resistant gonorrhea? So both the CDC and the WHO have come out with respective action plans, and they have several key components that they've outlined for that. But for this talk, I just want to discuss two of these, and that includes alternative effective treatment strategies and also looking at strengthening our AMR surveillance capabilities. So I think Australia is really sort of leading the way in terms of molecular gonodetection. I think this is largely attributable to the GRAND study, which several people are involved with and might be here today. It's an NHMRC-funded project which ran from 2012 to 2015. And essentially, there were two phases to this particular study. So the first phase was to try and better understand the spread and resistance of gono throughout Australia. And the second phase, which we'll be focusing on today, is essentially just talking about the development and the application of several of these molecular assays to apply them to direct testing for gononap-positive samples, with the aims to try and enhance our surveillance as well as exploring these alternative treatment options. So a really good example of the impact it sort of had in terms of here in Australia was this PPNG-PCR assay. Again, David Spears talked about this morning, and we looked at targeting the gonococcal plasmid, which carries this penicillinase gene, so penicillinase producing Neisseria gonorrhea, which is here, so the penicillinase gene is here, But the plasmid also has varying deletions as well, so we need to make sure that we target those as well when we want to try and identify these. So we looked at developing a PCR assay that targeted a conserved region to ensure that we were identifying these variants as well. So the great thing is that it's highly predictive of penicillin resistance, but it's important to note that it does not account for chromosomally mediated resistance to penicillin, and I'll be talking a little bit about that as well. So its application, I think, has been really great because we've been able to utilise it in remote settings in Australia, often where penicillin is still used to try and treat many of these regional and remote communities. And David Spears and colleagues here in WA have even utilised it to inform their own gonorrhea management guidelines, which I think is fantastic. So this essentially highlights the impact that a single PCR assay can have in terms of enhancing our bacterial culture capabilities that we already have set up in place for culture. So with the development of several of these assays, we also looked at doing a pilot study in the Northern Territory, and they specifically have sort of two regions where they have a CAS region where Darwin's located, and they rely on our current dual therapy guidelines, which is ceftriaxone and azithromycin. But for a lot of these regional and remote communities, they solely rely on these oral-based agents, which is a combination of amoxicillin and azithromycin called ZAPPAX. So we looked at testing all the bacterial isolates for gono in 2014, and we also looked at testing over 1,600 NAP-positive clinical samples as well through a variety of these assays. And what we found was that this table essentially just looks at the percentages for the resistances split up into region and then also split up into the culture versus the PCR. And then we also have the total here. And while there was general concordance occurring for resistance rates, it was interesting to note that culture did appear to overestimate both ciprofloxacin resistance and penicillin resistance as well, just highlighting that we have better coverage when we look at utilising NAP-positive clinical samples in these sort of remote settings. So aside from looking at surveillance, then how can we look at utilising these markers for another purpose? So one good option, I think, is looking at individualised therapy. One particular marker we're particularly interested in is ciprofloxacin resistance and the specific gyrase gene, specifically targeting codon 91. So we looked at this by assessing over 3,000 Australian gonorrhea isolates. And what's interesting to note here that the prediction for susceptibility, so predicting the wild-type version of this, the sensitivity and specificity rates are really high. And this is supported by a study by Geoffrey Klausner and colleagues who did a systematic review of several studies from multiple countries and showed that the pooled estimate for both sensitivity and specificity when looking at ciprosusceptibility was greater than 98%. So this really indicates to us that we can utilise this marker for hopefully individualised treatment. So essentially going beyond surveillance, we know that ciprofloxacin is highly effective as a single oral dose. And based on those previous findings, if we were to utilise this type of gyrase genotyping, then we could confidently say that 98% of patients could receive ciprofloxacin treatment. And this is fantastic for places like Australia at the moment, where a lot of our strains are actually still remain ciprofloxacin susceptible. So the benefits of this is that we can spare the use of ceftriaxone, which is always great considering it's our mainstay drug. And we can also look at expanding our oral treatment options for gonorrhea, which I think is always a huge bonus as well. So in terms of applying this type of gyrase genotyping, both Geoffrey Klausner and colleagues in the US have implemented this in a large-scale healthcare system already, and they subsequently found a significant reduction in ceftriaxone use. And we also have a study here that's just commencing here in Australia, which is led by Associate Professor David Wiley, called the GRAND 2 study. And it involves several clinics and associated labs, and we've also partnered with SpeedX on this to utilise one of their own assays. And our primary objectives for this is to, one, look at the cure rate, but also look at the acceptability of this sort of testing in the clinic as well. So the particular SpeedX assay that we're utilising is the Resistance Plus GC kit from SpeedX. It's been TGA cleared here in Australia, so it's readily available. And the great thing is that it has five targets for a single well. So it actually targets both OPA and PORA, which are diagnostic markers for gonorrhea. They also target both the wild-type version and the mutant version of this gyrase 91 codon specifically to determine either if it's susceptible or resistant. And they also have their own internal control as well to ensure that the reaction is working appropriately. So it's a real-time rapid PCR. And the great thing is that can be utilised for both urogenital and extragenital specimens as well. So I'm really looking forward to what that study brings in terms of the results, but can we actually look at individualizing treatment for other antibiotics, such as beta-lactams in general? We can, but it's a little bit more complicated. And David Spears touched on this morning, essentially that beta-lactam resistance in Neisseria gonorrhea is attributable to several genes, not just one. So it's a bit more challenging. And this can be due to things like the poor B gene associated with reduced entry, increased efflux due to the MTR efflux pump, and also reduced binding due to this PenA gene as well. And then on top of that, we also have penicillinase, which comes in and degrades the antibiotic. So the issue is that with these particular sequences for these genes, they are associated with resistance, but they're not typically predictive of resistance. But what we do know is that the wild type, so just the normal version of these, the susceptible version, is typically predictive of the susceptibility. So that's why we want to look at targeting susceptibility rather than resistance. So a good example of this is penicillin, and we looked at developing an assay that targeted wild type poor B and PPNG as well. And we looked at testing this over 3,000 isolates again. And if you just look at the combination of identifying both wild-type poor B and excluding PPNG isolates, you can see here that the specificity for that is really quite high, so it could be confident in providing them with appropriate treatment. The issue, however, is that it has a really reduced sensitivity rate, so approximately one-third of susceptible infections would be missed. And the other side issue for that as well is that it's not great at predicting resistance. So again, it sort of highlights the issues that we can sort of target susceptibility, hopefully, to try and get a better outcome for this. So another good example that's come up recently is the ceftriaxone-resistant strain and this mosaic PenA60 allele, which has been talked about by both David Spears and Deb this morning. And it's associated with this FC428 clone as well as this A2543 strain. Now, this particular A2543 strain was identified in 2018, and the National Neisseria Network had a rapid response to this, and within essentially a few weeks, they were able to identify and confirm that both the case from WA and the case in Queensland were in fact the same, and we also ended up developing this PCR that targeted this PenA60 allele. And subsequently from that, we ended up testing over several thousand NAT-positive clinical isolates from several states and territories here in Australia. So it sort of raises the question whether or not we could utilise this sort of stuff to ensure that ceftriaxone-resistant strains are appropriately treated. Currently, you might use something like gentamicin or ertapenem, which David Lewis might talk about later on. But it also could help us spare the use of things like zoliflodacin, which are still in the pipeline in terms of treatment options. So while it looks promising, there are still challenges that we still need to take into consideration for individualised treatment. And there are a couple of slides by David Spears this morning that looked at specifically ceftriaxone and cefexime and also azithromycin. But you can see here that the figure is pretty much the same, and there's two glaringly obvious things here. And that's sort of that AMR surveillance and individualized treatment go hand in hand, because we have these large gaps in AMR surveillance where we just don't know what's actually occurring in these countries. And it's a big issue that we really need to overcome. So we don't know whether or not individualized treatment trying to implement this in these countries would actually be beneficial or not. On the flip side, you have countries that display resistance rates almost nearing 100%, in this case for ciprofloxacin. And again, implementing this sort of individualized testing may not be appropriate for these countries. So it sort of highlights this as not a blanket approach that we can take. We definitely need to target this to key populations, and we definitely need to do our due diligence in seeing whether or not it's appropriate. Other issues that we face are discordant results that we need to take into consideration. So an individual might go to the clinic and they might be infected at multiple sites. One site might have a susceptible strain, while another site might have a resistant strain. So we need to ensure that we're actually testing individuals who have multi-site infections at all of their sites, and because this has been identified in a few other studies as well. And we also need to look at assessing the predictive value of these markers in other settings to make sure that we actually get it right. So in summary, I hope this sort of, you know, promotes the use of that we can utilize molecular testing for gonorrhea resistance, how it can be used to enhance our culture-based surveillance capabilities we already have implemented here in Australia, how it can look at informing alternative treatment options, as well as rapidly assessing our new markers, such as PenA60, that might pop up from time to time, that we really need to assess whether or not they're continuing spread here in Australia, but also whether or not they can be utilized for elsewhere. So with that, I'd just like to thank the following people, particularly David Wiley for providing the majority of these slides. Everyone who's been involved with the grant study is a lot of people, and thank you very much for the organisers for having me.